come back with much. Okay, but one thing, what we'll do is we'll look at Hawaii, and this won't take long because I'm only going to show you a few things. We'll imagine that it's a mantle plume that provides the volcanism here, and that it comes from either the core mantle boundary or maybe the top of a dense layer that's down there at the top of D double prime. And we'll see what, if you look at the details of what comes out of the volcanoes and how it might relate to what the plume looks like, what that might tell you about what's down there. So we'll start out by looking at the data from the drilling project. So the deep hole we've drilled is at the number 2 here, and it's in the Mauna Kea volcano. And the idea is that the present day the plume is, main melting region is down here. It's feeding Kilauea, Mauna Loa, and Lauihi, so it's in this region. And Mauna Kea, over the last several hundred thousand years, has been drifting off in this direction. So as you go back in time, as you go down the lava sequence, you sort of march back in time to see how Mauna Kea lavas looked as it crossed over the plume, and with some modeling of how the volcano samples the plume, you can sort of get some information about what might be radial structure in the plume. Okay, so what this amounts to is a 3-kilometer section of lavas. The top part's Mauna Loa, where we drilled, and then you got about 2.8 kilometers of Mauna Kea. And this goes from about 200,000 years ago at the top to about 600,000 years ago at the bottom. So that's 400,000 years. And if you add in the lavas that you can sample at the surface that span up to the present, you get about a 600,000 year history of this volcano, which means that's about 60 kilometers back along the track of the volcano over the plume. Okay, so this is basically the kind of picture that you see. There are geodynamical models that you can use to look at what the distribution of melt production in the plume is. This is a simplified representation of what you get out of those models, which is a simple kind of Gaussian distribution of melt supply, where you have a peak here just offshore near south of Kilauea, and it sort of dies off e to the minus x squared over a squared with distance. And this describes sort of the growth of the volcanoes pretty well. And I've actually got a movie stored on here somewhere if you want to see it sometime, that Mike Baker at Caltech has used this model to grow the Big Island with the idea that the magma's volcanoes capture magma from a circular area here, and you can grow the island and make it look pretty much like it does with this model. So it explains more, it deals with more than just isotope data. Okay, so as you go down section here in the lava section, and we convert it to age between 200 and, we're using a model age here, not the actual argon ages. So the bottom is 550 instead of 600. But the isotope ratios for neodymium, they change systematically. There's about as much short time scale variability as there is drift over the long time scale. And they go in the direction we would expect. They go from more morb-like at the top, out here at the edge of the melting region, to less morb-like over here. But they don't change all that much, really. And primitive Earth would be down at a scale of zero. Here, and the East Pacific Rise morb range is up in this region. Helium behaves differently. Helium actually changes from quite high values in the old rocks, which represent when the volcano was close to the center of the melting region, and it gets all the way down to the morb value here at 300,000 years ago, and it's essentially been morb-like since. So there's a real strong zoning in the helium isotope ratios. And as Don Anderson pointed out yesterday, actually, where you have high ratios, you also have a high variability in the helium isotope ratio. That is an observation that you get out of here, too. So you've got some kind of zoning that we figure is probably radial. But it's different for different isotopes, and I'll show you some of the other isotopes in a minute. But if you look at the helium, it's basically, you know, you got to get back in here when the volcano was pretty close to the middle of the melting region before you start seeing these values go up, and then it looks like more all the way out. The Big Island? Mauna Kea? You mean the summit or the place where we're sampling here? It was about 420,000 years ago. So the lavas below here were emplaced underwater, although most of them were erupted above water, flowed down the volcano, and then entered the ocean, and we're offshore. But you cross the shorelines, you go down because of subsidence, the first kilometer, 1.1 kilometers of the section, even though we started at sea level, is subaerial lavas that have since subsided below sea level. And below 1.1 kilometers, which is about 400,000 years or so, that's submarine lavas that were emplaced in a submarine. But we can tell from their gas contents that the first kilometer below that were lavas that were erupted in subaerial, degassed, and then emplaced underwater. And then the ones below 2 kilometers depth actually were erupted underwater because they still have their sulfur, their normal sulfur contents. Yeah, you want to do volcanology, we can go on for a long time on that. So if you take this geodynamic model that Reby and Christensen have done of Hawaii and look at the radius of the thermal anomaly, put it on the same kind of map, at a depth of about 170 or 200 kilometers before the thing starts spreading out, this is the full width of the thermal anomaly is something, well, it has a radius of about 130 kilometers. And the melting region that we're sampling most of the lava from, which is up higher after the plume starts spreading out, has a width of about 100 or 120 kilometers. And the region that, if you extend that back down to the region where I've shown the width of the thermal anomaly, the part of the plume that actually melts is only this big in comparison to the overall thermal anomaly. Now, if you define the width of the thermal anomaly as a sort of full width at half maximum or something like that, it would be smaller than this. Okay, this is all the way out to 2%. So it's like the whole thing. Okay, so if you superimpose, now what I've done here is taken not only the data from Mauna Kea, but data from the other volcanoes, and we made a map. This is published 2001. And this is what we think the contours in the plume look like for helium. And the numbers here in the red, I think, are above 30. So the region that has the high 3-4 ratios is embedded in a little narrow region in the center of the plume. We think it's in the center of the plume. It could be slightly offset from the center of the plume. We don't actually know that. And so when you look at the models that various people have done about how much, what's entrained from where, what we're sampling down here is the stuff that's really down there at the bottom of the mantle in the thermal boundary layer that would provide this hot material in the middle to melt. And then actually what melts, you barely get into any entrained lower mantle material, and nothing that melts is entrained upper mantle material. So we're only sampling what's really down there at the bottom. Now before I show you the pictures of the interpretation, so this is again the helium data versus age, showing the range getting down to more values here. Here's the strontium versus age, and here's where the East Pacific Rise Morb values are, somewhere down in here. There's no change, basically, from the top to the bottom of the section. So even though the helium anomaly three anomaly is concentrated in the middle part of the plume, the strontium anomaly is a much broader thing. Here's lead 208. And here's the osmium 187-188 ratio. This is probably lithosphere interaction in one of the late alkalic lavas, but there's not a lot of variability in the osmium either.
Is that work up the left? I mean, that's the strongest trend up there.
am I worried about the lead?
Could you say worried about?
Oh.
That's D double prime as well.
If this is coming from down there, yeah, that has to be coming from down there. The, yeah. There is a reasonable correlation between the thorogenic lead and the helium-3. Okay. So if you make a simple, this is not exactly dynamically correct, but the idea being that if you think of the plume coming from the Carmichael boundary, what's in the center part of the plume, as you go from the middle to the outer part of the plume, you're essentially looking at a vertical stratigraphy at the Carmichael boundary. And the helium goes from a large signal to practically nothing right away, whereas the strontium, remember that the only thing we're seeing in the lavas is about this. Okay. So we're seeing very little change in the strontium isotope ratios, and we're seeing a big change from having the helium-3 anomaly to having no helium-3 anomaly, all in that in the center part of the plume here. So there's something different. So because of the fact that it looks this way, one could conclude that, you know, the helium must be coming in there from, you know, an independent process from the strontium. The vertical axis is distance from the Carmichael boundary to the bottom of the lithosphere. This is the helium isotope ratios plotted across here, and the strontium ratios plotted here. I probably don't have the number right on this side. This should be a little bit, I'm sorry, for strontium. No, I got the strontium right. It's about 7026 or 27 in the East Pacific Rim.
Are we supposed to be thinking of helium now as a depletion of helium-4 rather than enrichment of helium-3?
You can think about it any way you want. All I'm telling you is that the signal's coming from the bottom here. Okay, now, if you want to think about it in the other version of having what's in the core of the plume be entrained material from a dense layer rather than from the Carmichael boundary, okay, then you would be getting the 3 helium anomaly out of the stuff entrained from the dense layer, let's say. Okay. But what this is telling you is that this is for Louise. Where is the dense layer and the stuff above it still both have this plume strontium. Okay, so you still need, in this case, a difference between this stuff and the Morb reservoir. Okay, so you still end up with sort of 3 layers down here. One that has the plume strontium but high 3-4, one that has the plume strontium but no high 3-4, and then the Morb reservoir somewhere up there yet. Okay. The width of the physical part of the plume?
Talking about some width, where it was coming with the radius.
Yeah. Okay. So the width of the plume, the ultimate constraints are the buoyancy flux that's necessary to produce the Hawaiian swell. What do you mean, non-unique?
Depending on where you put the depth, narrower.
That's not the only constraint. I mean, the buoyancy flux, the height to width ratio of the swell, which means and also the behavior of the material that comes as it's coming up the plume, the melting rate, and the thickness of the lithosphere all come into the model, because the thickness of the lithosphere affects the melting rate and the temperature. So the thicker you make the lithosphere, the hotter you have to make the plume in order to melt. The hotter you make the plume, the less viscous it becomes, and the narrower it becomes if you have a temperature-dependent viscosity. And so basically they tried a whole bunch of models, and in order to fit the height to width ratio, the melting rate, and adjusting the lithosphere thickness and get the right buoyancy flux, they had to have the plume have about this width. And I've taken then, they didn't discuss actually the width that much. So I used the Howry et al. Paper from 1994 where they tried to get some scaling between rheology, buoyancy flux, and width of the plume. Okay. And I took some simple approximations to what they found. And what I find is, I prefer the plume to be a little skinnier than they did it, because I think their melting region's a little bit too wide. But that also could just be a difference in the melting curve of the mantle material. But it turns out that it doesn't change that much. I mean, you can make it 20% smaller or something like that. But the reason you can't make it real narrow is that it requires that the plume viscosity be very low. And then you don't get the right behavior for the swell. And you also get very complicated, turbulent kind of behavior in the plume after it comes up underneath the lithosphere that there doesn't seem to be much evidence for. So that's, I mean, I wasn't going to talk about it that much, but you can read the paper. I would like to do more, have somebody doing more geodynamical modeling of the Hawaiian plume, but there's nobody doing it right now. So this is the way that I've interpreted these things. So, okay, so with osmium, Brandon et al. And Walker have found that some of the samples that have high helium-3-4 ratios also have an excess of osmium-186, and this they've interpreted as being a signal of osmium from the outer core. Now, there are some problems with this. I'm going to use a couple of slides here that actually are Vicki Lee's. So the basic idea is that as you build the inner core, you put more osmium into it than platinum. The partitioning is supposed to be that way, so that you end up with the outer core with a high platinum to osmium ratio. And then if it has a high platinum to osmium ratio, then the platinum 186 decays to, or platinum 190 decays to osmium 186, and you get this 186 excess. The problem with that is that in order to get a significant excess of 186 here, you have to make the inner core early, because it's a long half-life radioactive decay. So this is sort of, you need a special set of circumstances to even get the signal in the outer core that they're hoping for. This is another one of Vicki's slides, which shows that, there is also supposed to be a predicted correlation between 187 osmium and 186 osmium, which they also showed in the paper, but I don't have a figure for it. Now, recently, the other potential core signal is tungsten 182, which comes from hafnium isotope decay, but that's a short-lived radioactive isotope with whatever it is, a 7 million year half-life. Yeah, so anyway, they've claimed that they don't see any excess or any effect in tungsten isotopes in this paper that came out this year in Nature, and they claim that their preferred model is over here. They should expect to see shifts in epsilon tungsten over here that correspond to these shifts in osmium 186, and they claim they don't. However, even the fact that they didn't observe this doesn't necessarily negate the other observation, because where exactly this curve should be isn't all that clear. Okay. So that's about all I was going to say. So there are these hints that maybe there's some effect of the core. There's the point that I'm trying to make with, let me do this one other thing. And that is that if you look at some of the other lavas that have come out on the Big Island recently, like at Mauna Loa, this nice trend for neodymium in the Mauna Kea lavas. These black triangles are what's come out of Mauna Loa. And some of the data from Mauna Loa sort of look parallel to what you see in Mauna Kea. And we would expect them to be shifted downward a little bit, because Mauna Loa went over the middle of the plume melting region, closer to the middle than Mauna Kea. But then recently it's been doing this other thing here and getting these other values. And also with strontium, instead of going down with time, it's been going up with time with the isotope ratio. So my interpretation of this is that in order to explain this, that basically the central part of the plume has to be not only anomalous, but heterogeneous, so that you, with time, you get variability in the neodymium isotopes, and if you plotted helium, you would also see that, because the helium isotopes in these lavas have gone down to really low values like MORB. And so the final picture comes out like this, that not only is the core of the plume anomalous, it has the high helium in it, and so on, but also it varies with time and it's heterogeneous. And actually, this wouldn't be surprising, because any way you do it, the material that's, you're sweeping material from a pretty large area here into the middle of the plume, because the, if there's a thermal temperature gradient through here, you've got probably low viscosity material down at the bottom, and it's coming in here very fast. And Cinzia Farnitani's done some models of this, and you sweep up a lot of area into the middle of the plume, much less per unit time than what you at the velocities, upward velocities are much lower out here, so you're not bringing in material at quite from as large a distance. So you might expect it to be a little less heterogeneous as you get out onto the edges of the plume. So the, you know, this is, you can consider this to be, you know, a bedtime story, but it, the idea is that if you think about what you, what kinds of information you might be able to get out of looking at how the plume, the structure of the plume and how it's expressed in the lavas, this is the kind of thing you might be able to do with it if you were convinced you were doing it right. So, we'll just leave it there. Has a radius of between 15 and 25 kilometers, probably something like that.
Geodynamic calculations allow this.
15 to 25 kilometers. I'm talking the internal, the helium, the anomalous helium core of the plume.
That's where the
yeah, it's not the entire plume.
Yeah, actually, right, and yeah, but Jelinek and Manga have another paper coming out where they estimate what the width of this tendril should be.
And but the tendril being just the narrow part, there's a whole wider conduit going around yeah. that that's carrying stuff up.
Right, but the entrained stuff, it's the entrainment problem. How much of the dense layer do you get in there, and how wide is the tendril? And, you know, they're getting the tendril coming out to be with, you know, a diameter of 20 or 30 kilometers, something like that.
But within your column, melting's only taking place in the uppermost part? Or are they having melting anywhere in the central part of the plume?
You're talking about up at the top?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was going to talk more about this tomorrow when we talk about plumes. And I talked a lot about it last week, the week before. But yeah, in order to get melting underneath thick lithosphere, you have to have very high potential temperature, and it turns out that only the central part of the plume is hot enough. So if you're, you know, if your thermal anomaly is 300 degrees, if you have 300 degree excess potential temperature, probably only the stuff that has an excess potential temperature above 240 degrees, it melts. Everything else never gets crosses the melting region.
Right. And what depth is that happening?
That happens between 90 and 150 kilometers.
Okay.